This is the Collaborative Ependymoma Research Network's podcast for winter 2014. In this special podcast, we'll be highlighting some of the important research presented by CERN-supported investigators at the 19th annual meeting of the Society for Neuro-Oncology that was held November 13 through 16 at the Loews Hotel in Miami Beach. With me now is Dr. Mark Gilbert, the Chief Medical Officer and Principal Investigator of the CERN Foundation. Dr. Gilbert, in Friday's session at the SNO meeting this week, you presented important findings regarding a CERN-funded phase 2 clinical trial involving two drugs called lapatinib and temozolomide. Can you share with our listeners, in general terms, the results of this trial?
Yes, so this represents the first prospective clinical trial in patients with a recurrent ependymoma, so it was a milestone trial. And in this trial, we combined two agents that had not been put together before for the treatment of cancer. Temozolomide is an oral chemotherapy agent that's very commonly used for brain tumors. And it's unique in the fact, as an oral agent, it is readily able to cross into tumor and bypassing the blood-brain barrier. Lapatinib is a drug that has been developed primarily for breast cancer. The reason we were interested in looking at lapatinib for ependymoma is that the target of lapatinib is a particular protein called HER2 or ERBB2. It's the same protein. This is very commonly found in a subset of breast cancer, but also found in a percentage of patients with ependymoma. So we thought by combining the two agents, we may see synergy and better treatment response than either agent alone. So we embarked on this clinical trial. We enrolled 50 patients with recurrent or regrowing ependymoma. What we found is that nearly half of the patients had their tumor controlled for over a year. This is a remarkable finding given that past records of other chemotherapy treatments done for ependymoma have failed to achieve this benchmark. In addition, some of the patients had very dramatic responses with tumor shrinkage. We did have patients, particularly with spinal cord ependymoma, who showed dramatic improvement in their symptoms. We had patients who were unable to walk, who after several months of treatment became ambulatory. So we were quite enthusiastic about the results. And our colleagues, after the presentation here at the Society for Neuro-Oncology meeting, were equally enthusiastic.
That's very encouraging. Congratulations. As part of your ongoing research, you're looking for predictive markers that would suggest a response to therapy. Can you describe for us how this trial could contribute to this research?
So one of the components of the trial was the expectation that there would be patients who responded, and as in most clinical trials in cancer, some who didn't. And we thought there would potentially be an opportunity to see if we could figure out who was going to respond and who was not going to respond on the basis of the molecular or genetic characteristics of their tumor. So we tried wherever possible to collect samples of tumor tissue and to investigate it in the laboratory. So we had approximately 24 samples that were available for this type of evaluation, and we looked at three separate analyses. And what we found is that we saw differences between the responders and non-responders. Now, of course, with such a small sample, it is very hard to make a statement that is definitive, but this encourages us to move forward and to continue this line of research and see if we can find a genetic pattern that predicts for response. Clearly, if that's the case, then we would offer this treatment to patients with that genetic response and look for other treatments for patients whose tumors don't have the same genetic markers.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Gilbert. With me now is Dr. Terry Armstrong, our Project 5 leader for patient outcomes and symptom management. Dr. Armstrong, the study looking at Temodar and lapatinib presented by Dr. Gilbert also included patient-reported outcomes. Can you help us to understand what patient-reported outcomes, or PROs, are?
Absolutely. Thanks for the question. One of the goals that we have within CERN is not only to evaluate the impact of therapy on the tumor, but to understand the impact on the patient. And one of the primary ways we have to do that is through what are called patient-reported outcomes, or PROs. What these are questionnaires that allow a patient to tell us exactly that, how they're doing. They'll tell us how severe their symptoms are, how well they're functioning, and we're able to use those tools over time to fully evaluate the impact of the treatment on the patient.
And what did you find in the study?
Well, we were excited to find that while the treatment improved the progression-free survival, it also improved patient symptoms during that time. So with ependymoma, there are patients who have tumors within the brain and patients who have tumors within the spine. And through the use of separate questionnaires, we were able to evaluate those specific symptoms that are important to them. For example, those patients with spinal cord tumors, over time, as we controlled the tumor, we also improved their weakness as well as their pain. And those with brain tumors, we improved not only their function, but their cognitive function as well.
I understand the FDA supports the use of these measures. Can you tell us about that?
It's really an exciting initiative that's being funded through several patient advocacy groups, and we were happy to be a part of this. It was launched with a workshop that was held in October of this year through these advocacy groups, as well as the FDA, Society of Neuro-Oncology, and others. And we met to discuss how these endpoints should be included in all brain tumor trials. So through our work in CERN, we're setting the stage for work that will affect patients with all types of brain tumors.
The CERN Foundation is interested in the impact of ependymoma both in children and adults. Can you share with our listeners the work presented at the SNO conference?
Absolutely. We were able to have three separate abstracts presented at SNO, outlining some work we're doing and understanding both the impact on patients' mood, their level of uncertainty, and fostering hope. We recognize that being diagnosed with a brain tumor can be difficult emotionally to deal with, as well as dealing with the side effects of the treatment. So our work has shown that patients, from the time of diagnosis throughout the illness, even when they're not on treatment any longer, still are plagued with issues of uncertainty, how to deal with the disease, are they going to need other treatment, what symptoms are coming next. And through this work, along with our colleagues Dr. Lin Lin, as well as Alvina Akwe and myself, we're able to identify that there may be interventions that we can do to improve patients' hope, thereby improving their mood and helping them cope with the diagnosis.
Thank you for your time, Dr. Armstrong. I'm joined now by Kimberly Walgren, who serves as the CERN Foundation's patient and outreach liaison. Kim, you're the daughter of a patient with ependymoma, and you participated in a caregiver advocate panel during the annual meeting of the Society for Neuro-Oncology this week, which received rave reviews. Can you outline for us some of the topics that were discussed by the panel?
Sure. Thank you, Chaz, for this opportunity. I was invited to speak on the caregiver panel, along with two other women, Petra and Helen. And I decided to talk about the importance of kindness in medical relationships and ways to identify opportunities. I find that frequently the medical community is interested in doing more for their patient and their patient relationships, but often don't know how the patient wants to be contacted or connected with. And so I gave specific examples from our community and also of my own that shared times when either physicians or nurses or techs showed us kindness, and it made a profound effect on our life. And I think that is something that is often underestimated. The importance of this is often underestimated, but I think it can have a very big impact in people's lives, a lasting impact as well. Petra has a lot of experience with caregiving, as she lost her husband to glioblastoma 4 years ago. She gave a talk, Who Cares About the Caregiver? And it was very interesting how she identified that not only did she feel alone and isolated during this experience, but that also her children, no one really knew what to do with them, and that they did go through their own sort of mourning the loss of their father, and they needed more attention. So she has developed a quality of life application that you can develop or that you can download on your smartphone. It is not available yet, and she's working on developing it, but it's really amazing, and it can track quality of life goals that your entire family has, so patient, caregiver, and the children, and you can measure how things are going. And the last speaker, Helen, is a parent of a daughter with brain cancer, and she has also had experience with the cancer herself. And when they live in the UK, when her daughter was diagnosed, she felt isolated and that she had no support group. And so she has created an organization called the Brains Trust in the UK, so that when you're thrown into this very difficult time in your life, you can find support through other brain tumor families and caregivers. She believes in social support and thinks it's very important, especially to the caregiver community. So after the panel, presentation, we had a few questions from the audience, and we had very good discussion about things that were most important to the caregiver, and all three of us agreed that cognitive function and behavior decline were some of the most important changes we noticed in our family, and also the hardest changes, and that we need to identify tools to help caregivers cope with these sorts of things. And there's many resources out there that identify specific to the brain tumor community issues that caregivers face. The ABTA has a handbook for caregiving on their website you can download. Helen has quite a few pamphlets through the Brain Trust that are very helpful. They really identify discussion questions, and that's a really good start, is to just get your family communicating and talk about some of these hard issues. And even beyond the immediate family, we see this carry over to aunts and uncles and cousins, and it's hard on everyone. And so I think through communication, you can really help identify what's going on as a family and try to find ways to support each other. There were also two great talks before the panel discussion. Now, the first was by Dr. Eugene Huang, and then the second was Dr. Heather Conklin at St. Jude, and they discussed issues about cognitive impact and pediatric survivors, and I hear the parent group often talking about this, and Dr. Huang has identified risk factors such as age and sex that do impact the cognitive function later on, and Dr. Conklin is looking at how to minimize some of this decline. She's doing a study currently on adding exercise during treatment. And so they're both doing very exciting work to help improve cognitive function for pediatric survivors. The other takeaway that I want everyone to understand is that caregivers are extremely important, and they have to take care of themselves, and we don't want the caregivers to become a new patient community. And there's ways, again, I mentioned, getting enough sleep, eating properly, getting help when you need it, talking to someone. These are all things that you can do to keep yourself healthy so that you can take care of the patient. But I think that when you also need to have a doctor that you can talk to and identify the difficulties you're going through, and it's best to communicate those to a medical professional. Paula Sherwood at the University of Pittsburgh also had a great talk about what we know and where we should go. And what she said something that really stuck with me, and that was that being a caregiver to a brain tumor patient is different than any other caregiver group, but we haven't been able to define it yet in the literature. So it's something that we all feel and we all know, we're doing this at home. But we haven't been able to define what exactly that is. Caregiving for a brain tumor patient is similar to dementia caregiving and general cancer caregiving. There's elements that are similar, but it is a very unique and needs to be more research done on that.
You currently serve as the patient liaison for the CERN Foundation. If our listeners want to contact you, what's the best way for them to do so?
You can email me anytime at kwallgren@cern-foundation.org. And I encourage everyone to become a part of our Facebook community. We do put out frequent updates and projects that you can participate in, such as the EO Project. And of course, our Awareness Day event that we are encouraging people to host local events and create some buzz in your community. And however that fits you personally, those are things that we'd like to see people get involved And one, you know, when we are able to meet with other foundations and people who have gone through this experience, I'm just amazed at how many wonderful ideas people have in the community and their passion. And so if you have an idea or a passion to help improve the lives of people with brain cancer, I really encourage you to contact me or contact someone who's done something similar and keep going with it, because we need to make some noise and spread the awareness about this disease so that we can try to come up with some solutions for all of us.
Thank you, Kimberly. I'm joined now by Dr. Richard Gilbertson, co-principal investigator of the CERN Foundation. Dr. Gilbertson, your presentation during the annual SNOW meeting this week was entitled Ependymoma, The Story So Far. In layman's terms, can you provide our listeners with a brief overview of your talk and share with us the progress that you and your colleagues have made in better understanding this difficult disease?
Sure. I mean, the story in ependymoma is really quite exciting. It's a disease that really up until about 14 years ago, we knew very little about. We began to understand that although ependymomas can occur throughout the nervous system, that's in the front of the brain, the back of the brain, and the spine, we knew they behaved differently, but we had no idea why. So what's happened in the time over that 14 years is we've started to understand that these tumors have different genetic defects in them that drive them. We understand that they arise from different cell types, which is very important, so we see that they're born in completely different cells. And that's important because if you understand where something comes from, you can start to understand how it goes wrong, and therefore you can start to design treatments against it. And then the last aspect is really we've been able to devise new models that help us to understand how the disease develops, to understand how to treat it. So we've been able to identify completely new genetic defects that drive the disease. What's incredible is although ependymoma is a fairly rare disease, it's one of the most frequent events that happens in any brain tumor that's identified so far. That's when two genes that normally are separated get stuck together and generate a completely new protein, and that makes a tumor in a brain. So completely unexpected result. And so we're now developing drugs that will target that abnormal protein. Now, the beauty of that is because you don't find that protein in the normal brain, it's completely abnormal, then theoretically drugs that prevent it doing its job shouldn't be toxic, because they're not going to be targeting any normal protein that we found in the rest of the brain or the body.
In light of these new findings overall, what do you see on the horizon for ependymoma research?
So I think there are two particularly exciting areas. One is new drug development. So we've instigated a very large drug development program at St. Jude, which is actually looking for completely new drugs. That's not just repurposing drugs that are already in the clinic to see if they'd work against ependymoma. That's starting from scratch with brand new chemicals and making them into drugs that would inhibit and kill ependymoma cells. So that's very exciting. The other aspect is just understanding the basic biology of ependymoma. We've now put in place models that develop into ependymomas. We've got in place understanding of what cells generate ependymomas. And we also have, as I mentioned, the genetic defects that drive ependymoma. So all the building blocks that make an ependymoma are now in place. So we can really start to understand how this disease forms from the beginning, so that we can really try to affect both initial primary tumors in terms of treatment, and also, if it comes back, how we could treat relapse disease.
That's terrific. Thank you, Dr. Gilbertson.